I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. I'd like to thank everyone for being here today. We have a number of work sessions that we have bills scheduled for. We also have a public hearing. For those who are here for the work sessions, Senate Bill 119 is not going to be worked today. Apparently there's some issues, I think, on amendments or something to that effect. So we do not have the paperwork back that we need to move forward on Senate Bill 119. It will be rescheduled another time. We have two other bills to be worked. What I'm going to do is start with Senate Bill 563 as a work session, and we have another member who's supposed to be on his way, and we're going to see if we can have him here before we work that bill, which will be Senate 556. And
oh, there he is.
I tell you what, since we haven't started that, and Senator Byer's now here, I'm going to go ahead and go in the order that I had planned on. We're having a work session, opening a work session on Senate Bill 556. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 556 is the increases the number of days an employer gets for contesting an occupational safety violation. It has a dash 2 amendment. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Would you like me to describe the dash 2 amendment, Mr. Chair?
Please.
The dash 2 amendment increases the time frame from the current 20 days to 30 days for contesting an occupational safety violation. It changes the time frame for an employee to contest the time to fix the violation from 20 days to 30 days, and it also changes the recording of a final judgment lien from the current 10 days to 20 days. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So with that, at this point, Senator Byer, I believe the dash 2s are amendments that had been worked on, and my understanding, if I remember correctly, all of those who had given testimony before were buying off and were agreeing that the dash 2s were fine. So if you want to make a motion on the dash 2s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 556.
Senator Byer has moved the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 556. Any discussions? Any objection? It will be ordered. Senator Byer?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 556 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves Senate Bill 556 as amended with the dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Byer, will you be so kind to carry this one?
Be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 556. We're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 563. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 563 requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to approve managed care organizations' treatment standards, adopting the standards for injured workers instead of the actual treatments. adopting the process for approving the process for adopting the standards instead of actually adopting the actual treatment standards. This is a problem that was with Senate Bill 760, and we heard about it on March 14th, and Senator Walker brought this bill to us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was going to say that's easy for you to
say.
All right.
It was
so
clear in my head.
We're there. And there is no amendments for this bill.
There is no amendments, and there's no revenue impact or fiscal impact. Thank you.
All right. Senator Byer, do you feel comfortable making a motion on Senate Bill 563?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 563 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves Senate Bill 563 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And any volunteers to carry 563?
It's Senator Walker's bill.
Oh,
maybe she would like to carry
good idea.
Very good idea. We love to delegate. We will delegate this to Senator Walker. All right, so that's going to take care of the work sessions. For those who weren't here when I opened up the work session, Senate Bill 119 will not be worked today because we're waiting for amendments, and they are not available at the time we started our meeting today. So we're going to move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 788. This will only be a public hearing. We have a number of people who have signed up. I also want to give notice to those that are here, as well as to my committee. I have been asked to participate in a meeting at about 30 minutes or so. So I will be leaving at some time. It's not because I don't want to hear the testimony. It's just that My day has gotten a little bit more, let's say, tight and restricted. And so if we do not get through all the testimony at that time, Senator Beyer, if he's able to stay, will take over the rest of the public hearing. So with that said, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 788. And we have a number of people who have signed up. And what I want to do is, I guess we have one individual here that has a child, and I was wondering if you were going to be testifying, because if you are, I'll be more than glad to have you come on up and testify if you're going to be testifying. That way, if you need to leave, you'll feel free to leave without not being able to give your testimony. So if you would like to come on forward, I'd love to hear from you now. And as she's coming up, Leslie Fran and Janice O'Malley.
And Duke,
I'm going to have you kind of second chairing. So if the others two want to come up and... The way this has been described to me, the first panel was going to be Leslie, Janice, and I know Duke. Duke, we'll let you come up as soon as we have one of the other three testify. And so I'm assuming that Leslie or Janice is going to kind of give us the overview. Okay, if you'd give us your name for the record, and whoever's going to go first can go ahead and begin.
Good afternoon. First, I want to thank Senator Pozanski and the members of the committee for giving us this opportunity to share our thoughts with you. My name is Leslie Frain, and I serve as Executive Director of SEIU Local 503.
Leslie, you don't need to be quite as close to the mic. It's pretty sensitive, okay. And what happens is we get feedback, and it goes into the system. Is
this better?
That's great.
Okay. Our union represents 40,000 members in Oregon, including 5,000 license-exempt child care providers. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 788, a bill that would codify the terms of Governor Kulongoski's executive order granting collective bargaining rights to family child care providers. The 5,000 license-exempt child care providers in our union provide high-quality care in their homes for three or fewer low-income children. They provide care at all hours of the day at night and night on weekdays and weekends. Without the services of our members, there are many low-income parents who would be unable to continue working because childcare would become unavailable, unaffordable, or both. For the childcare providers themselves, making ends meet is a challenge. Even when they care for the maximum of three kids, license-exempt providers earn below minimum wage. They have neither health insurance nor workers' compensation coverage. They have no paid sick days, and it has been over a decade since the hourly subsidy rates paid by the state have increased. Technically, in addition to the subsidies, providers receive a copayment from parents. But in reality, so few parents can afford this expense that the copays are commonly called no-pays. Child care is a low-paid occupation throughout the country, but Oregon has lower subsidy rates and higher parent copays than most other states. Federal guidelines call for child care subsidy rates sufficient to enable parents to access 75% of available child care slots. In Oregon, however, the most recent market study found that with current rates, low-income parents can access only 25% of available slots. 2 years ago, when child care workers in Oregon began talking about forming a union, the conversations always seemed to begin the same way. The providers talked about how they love the kids they care for and how proud they are of providing safe, secure, and reliable care. They talked of the joy of watching kids thrive and grow, of helping them with school readiness. Finally, they talked about how forming a union would give them an opportunity to improve the child care program, to gain training, and to make enough economic progress that they can afford to continue doing the work that they love. On behalf of those providers, I want to thank Governor Kulongoski, whose executive order granting collective bargaining rights to family child care providers represents a huge stride forward toward providing the voice that our members are seeking. But by their very nature, executive orders are temporary fixes. And that's why Senate Bill 788 is so important. If passed, it will give these providers, like other workers, the security of knowing that their rights are protected by statute. It will also codify parents' absolute right to select the qualified provider of their choice, be that a grandparent or neighbor or a center-based program. It will prohibit strikes, since strikes have no place in the family child care program. The governor's executive order started us down the right path. I'm proud to report that we've made further progress down that path by reaching an historic first agreement with the state of Oregon on behalf of our child care members. If funded by this legislature, this agreement will reduce the copays charged to parents by 20%. It will expand access to the child care program by increasing parents' income eligibility limit to 185% of the federal poverty level. It will provide significant funding for training for license-exempt providers. Finally, it will increase the subsidy rate for a provider in the Salem area who cares for three children to $6.60 an hour, with Portland area providers earning $7.92 an hour. Through the budget process, the legislature will decide whether to fund our settlement. But for the future of child care, in many ways, Senate Bill 788 is as important as the budget process. Its passage will make it possible for providers to continue to work collectively to reduce turnover, to improve quality, to advocate for the kids they care for, and to professionalize the work that they do day in and day out to protect and to nurture our children.
Hello, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Janice O'Malley, and I am with AFSCME Council 75. And I just want to let you know that what was handed out to all of you were a couple of letters, one from our union representative who represents our child care providers, Faye Zepeda, as well as Sue Mackey, who's a child care provider that wasn't able to be here today, and also our provider bill of rights that we bargained this past fall, which is actually the first of its kind in the country. We're here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 788. We represent about 4,400 registered certified child care providers in the state. And a couple years ago, these providers statewide decided to organize a union with AFSCME because they wanted to have a say in the rules, the regulations, health and safety, and an increased subsidy rate that affects their private businesses. And some people have asked, you know, why couldn't they have formed an association? Why a union? And to be quite honest, after 12 years of having the lowest subsidy rates in the country, after hearing countless of people call them babysitters, and having such a large turnover rate with no compensation for health care, training, and people paying more for doggy daycare than for child care, this was not the legacy that they wanted for their profession. And so as a result, the great governor of the state granted these providers the right to meet and confer, and just recently granted them the right to collectively bargain. And like I said, we bargained the Bill of Rights, which is first in the country, and it includes the right to be treated as a professional with courtesy, dignity, and respect. And we're also working with the legislature to fully fund a subsidy increase to the 75th percentile, which is the federally recommended percentile. And just as a side note, the state of Oregon actually received a letter from the federal government basically saying that we're out of compliance for having the subsidy rates so incredibly low. And just in closing, we really have this unique opportunity this session to seriously impact these men and women in this profession. And we need to have it strengthened in statute that these providers may continue to have the right to work as a team with the agencies into making the great strides in the quality of care that is given to the children of Oregon, regardless of who is governor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lee Welch. I am a child care provider, and I live in the Littleton, Beaverton area. I am here to support the Senate Bill 788, which will give us a real collective bargaining rights. I think Senate Bill 788 will help us turn child care into a respective job. I am a certified nanny, I am a certified trained nanny with 16 years of experience. I am a single mom with a 15-month-old son who has severe allergies. I cannot stay in this job without a pay increase, health care benefits. That is why I'm asking you to support this bill. and I'm also dealing with my friend's child who has behavior issues as well. So thank you very much.
Lee, thank you very much for being here. Before y'all take off, let me just ask if there's any questions for anyone that's testified at this point.
Chair.
Yes. Senator Beyer, hope the question's
thank
for...
the best
for
example yet of how you earn the money.
Leslie, or...
why you need more.
Yeah.
No, actually, the... I guess my first question is, who's the employer of the these employees? I mean, I'm trying to... Unions are usually unionized employees to negotiate with an employer.
This situation is a little unusual that way. The child care providers are not employees in that they operate their own businesses. In the case of licensed providers, for licensed exempt, we don't traditionally think of them as their own businesses, but they are not officially employees of the state. What this bill would do and what the executive order did is grant collective bargaining rights simply for the purposes of negotiating over those terms that the state controls, albeit not as an employer, because the state, although it is not the employer, and the bill is very clear about that, does control the subsidy rates and a number of the regulations and the regulations that affect the providers and the whole system. So they don't have an employer except to the extent that the parents who put the children in their care have control over many of the decisions that a traditional employer would make. We're not trying to turn the state into the employer of these providers.
Well, I guess that's where my confusion is, because you know, a union is organized to negotiate with an employer. And if we don't have an employer, I mean, and you said you could have formed an association, and that's the way most, or as far as I know, every other independent business people do. If they want to get together and talk about issues and do training or whatever they want to do, they do it through associations.
Well, Chair Pozanski and Senator Beyer, this is new to everyone, to be quite honest. And we are acting as their professional association, plain and simple.
Is not the employer, but the state does set the subsidy rates. So the state does have a larger voice than anyone in terms of the core economic conditions under which the providers work.
It's kind of similar to the health care providers, if I'm not mistaken, in the sense of technically the individual who's receiving the services is deemed to be the employer, mm-hmm. But in reality, from my perspective, and you can quote me on this, I mean, there are controls that the state has in the sense of the money, and it's somewhat considered a pass-through, and so that is how we have been able to articulate a way of having the hybrid type of system that we have. I think that someone could actually potentially make a claim that maybe they are actually state employees because of the controls that are in place, but that's for another day, another committee. And
I get one follow-up question, final question, I guess, Mr. Chair. And I don't know how this applies, but in associations, and if businesses want to get to the form of association, if they get to the point of negotiating or talking about setting rates, it's something called antitrust violations. And why is it that when you take independent business people and put them together in, you know, it is really an association, and you're going to collectively bargain for that association, why is that not an antitrust violation?
Two things. One is I think that the statute has the ability to carve out, I believe the statute actually addresses that question. Certainly, I know there's been a lot of discussion among the drafters of it. But in this case, it's an antitrust violation when a group of contractors or whatever who would normally potentially get different rates from different providers say, no, we're all going to work for the same rate. What makes this different is the state sets one rate. So there is already one rate and one negotiation. There is no competition going on. And antitrust regulations are designed in order to avoid competition being clamped down on. There is no competition in the system because it is one rate set for all providers automatically.
That's fine for now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a request. I see two young women sitting on the front row. They look like They're really smart and future leaders. Could we have them come up and sit with the panel?
If they would like to.
To broaden their experience.
As soon as I get up here, I'm going to move the bill with the due pass. I think we've got the votes now.
Yeah. Since you're joining us at the request of Senator Gordley and all of us, we do have one request, and that's you're going to have to identify yourself for the record so everyone who's on TV watching us knows who's sitting up with us, because we don't have name tags for you.
I'm Markeba Spikes.
Hey, Markeba, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, what age you are, what school you go to?
I'm 8, and I'm going to Rosa Parks School, and I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Great. And your friend next to you is?
And I'm Kylie Gray, and I'm almost 9, and I go to Boone Ferry Primary down in Wilsonville, and I'm from Oregon, Portland.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, ladies, for joining us. And if you have any questions from anyone that comes up here, all you have to do is raise your hand. And if I'm not here, Senator Beyer will make sure you have an opportunity to ask some questions. Okay? But okay. All right. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
So our next panel is Chris Warner, Aaron Kelly Seal, I guess it is, and then
Duke.
And Duke Shepherd.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the Human Services Policy Advisor to Governor Ted Kulongoski. I work on issues for him relating to children and families, as well as mental health and addiction, and it's a privilege to be here in front of you today to testify in support of Senate Bill 788 and just to put some perspective around the governor's support for this very important initiative. I think I want to paint the broader picture in terms of the governor's vision looking ahead at the potential that we have in the state, this biennium, to make a real difference for kids and families. There are several initiatives that are moving through this body that relate directly to that opportunity and that will have a huge impact on kids and families, the Healthy Kids Initiative, the redesign of Oregon's self-sufficiency program, this particular bill, and the investments that correlate with it, as well as some investments in alcohol and drug treatment. All of these things are really designed to be front-end supports for children and families in the state so that we can avoid some of the more costly consequences that we've observed occurring over the last several years, like increased numbers of children in foster care who are there longer, kids who are showing up at school not quite as ready as maybe they should be, or kids who are struggling to stay in school and are having trouble graduating on to that next step in their life, whether that's opportunity to go to work or the opportunity to go on from high school to higher education. Quality child care is a huge priority and a huge piece of this for two reasons. One, it enables parents to actually go to work and be active participants in our economy if that's their choice. But it also has a critical impact in terms of early childhood development. Most of our youngest children in the state will be in some form of child care at one time or another during their most formative years, and that's between the ages of 0 and 5. Studies are conclusive that children in high-quality child care demonstrate better cognitive functioning and social skills and have fewer behavior problems down the line than children who aren't able to access high-quality care. Quality depends on a couple of things, but two of them are really addressed in this bill. One is the education and training that caregivers are offered and have access to, and the other is staff turnover rates at child care facilities or in a child care home. Caregiver training and the continuity of relationship between a child and their caregiver are the two measures that this bill would enable the state to positively impact. When we create the opportunity through better reimbursement and employee benefits like training and health care to recruit and retain quality child care providers, the children and their families directly benefit. We get a more stable child care workforce, which means parents have options and can find the best fit for their child. When we reduce turnover, that also means that children are able to bond with their caregivers and are able to develop socially in a more positive way, making them more ready for school. As a middle-income parent who herself has struggled to find child care that's a great fit for my 22-month-old, high-quality child care, I can only imagine what it's like for families that are not as fortunate as I am in their search for the right and best place for their child to be for most of the day. And that's really what this is about. We have a huge opportunity here to improve the availability of quality child care and education, in particular for some of Oregon's lowest income families who want to be self-sufficient and who want to be doing the best they can for their kids. This bill moves forward really what are the four cornerstones for an effective child care infrastructure: quality, safety, accessibility, and affordability. And so I urge you to just take advantage of this opportunity, and I thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chris Warner. I'm the governor's labor and transportation policy advisor. I'll be brief because I see you have a lot of folks that are on the front lines that would like to talk about this. I'd just like to give you a few observations in terms of the work that the governor's office has been doing over the past couple of years on this issue, and it's critically important. I think it's reflected in our budget, but also in the people that you have behind us that actually provide the services and that provide that quality daycare that Aaron talked about that is so important. Certainly, the governor's issued three executive orders dealing with this. The first was in September of 2005, dealing with the licensed daycare providers, and that was part of the meet and confer process. We also issued another one in December, or in early 2006, that dealt with the license exempt folks that are here behind us as well. Part of those was part of the meet and confer process, and as working with state agencies and the work that they've done, it was an extraordinary process in terms of the understanding and the give and take that came through with that process. And as part of that, how successful that was, we went ahead and went on forward with this collective bargaining executive order that was issued earlier this year. And this legislation really, in codifying that agreement, I think really takes us to the next level in terms of professionalizing this. I think Aaron outlined very succinctly how important this is, not only for the children, but also for making sure that people are given the opportunity to work and to make a living for their family. So we see this as a win both on the worker side, but also for the families that take advantage of this daycare and the services that the state provides for that. So with that, I'd just like to thank the committee for looking at this. We look forward to working with you in terms of any kind of technical amendments or anything on the bill, but it's certainly an important part of the governor's agenda to move forward with healthy families, and this is a great part of that. So I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, Senators, Ms. Spikes, Ms. Gray, as the leading Federation of Labor Unions in Oregon, the AFL-CIO represents groups of individuals who choose to organize themselves for the purpose of collective bargaining. Unions are formed by workers for the purpose of collective bargaining because those workers believe that they have the right and the responsibility to be equal partners in solving problems and addressing issues in the workplace. Child care providers have this belief in their rights and responsibilities and have been fortunate that Governor Kulongoski has extended to them the privilege of meeting and conferring on their issues. However, meeting and conferring is a limited set of conversations with limited reliability over time. It's far less than collective bargaining. Because this meet and conferability has been granted to them via executive order, it functions as a privilege subject to the occupant of the governor's office. We believe that collective bargaining is a right that all people should have available to them should they choose to exercise it without being dependent upon the opinion of a governor. Collective bargaining results in better wages, benefits, and working conditions for people who choose to exercise their right to pursue it in their workplace. Beyond the typical areas that come to mind for collective bargaining, but in our experience of equal or greater importance to most workers, is the ability to discuss and reach agreement on issues that have to do with quality of service and quality of care, safety for workers, clients, and customers. These are the issues that benefit the most from the perspective of frontline working professionals, and these are some of the issues that child care providers are addressing in their current efforts. We urge the committee to grant these workers the ability to exercise their rights and responsibilities within their industry so that they may have a meaningful and legally recognized place at the table as partners through collective bargaining. Thank you.
Mr. Shepherd, we may know who you are, but you need to state your name for the record, please.
Duke Shepherd, Oregon AFL-CIO. Very sorry.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I have one, and I don't know who the best person to answer it be, but what happens? You have set new collective bargaining rates, currently, I assume, and provider rates. What happens if the legislature doesn't fund that?
Chair Beyer, I think that question actually highlights the reason for this piece of legislation, at least part of it. Currently, under the meet and confer process, what was agreed to was that the Department of Human Services would put forward an agency request that reflected the agreement that was reached between the two parties. And in this case, the governor endorsed that through his recommended budget. But I think everybody has recognized that the challenge is now that we need to be working together with you all to make sure that actually comes to pass. What I think is strengthened through this bill is the opportunity to be certain that those kinds of agreements actually do come to pass once they've been made.
Okay, but you still didn't answer the question. What happens if the legislature doesn't fund it, even if this bill was to pass and an agreement was made with the workers? What happens if the legislature won't fund that?
Well, I think my understanding is that it would reset the baseline for that next set of discussions that we would have.
Okay, because under the collective bargaining agreements with employees, if the legislature doesn't fund the increased salaries, the agencies have to cut workers.
Well, I think in this case, we're kind of talking about two different processes. The first, which is reflected in this budget, was a meet and confer process. And so we haven't had discussion yet about what would happen to the rate increase. But again, we're not the employer of these folks. And so what's being impacted by the legislature's choice to fund or not fund is the rate that they currently receive, which, as you've heard, is already one of the lowest in the nation. And so going forward, though, we would be under a different kind of agreement with folks, which would be a collective bargaining agreement. And I think that the obligations are different under each of those, but I think we're certainly concerned and want to be able to address what's been agreed to thus far, and that's part of the reason that this is a partnership.
So I guess I'm going to have to assume you don't know what would happen if this bill was to pass and an agreement was reached for a certain level of rates and the legislature chose not to fund that.
If you're asking prospectively, I guess I'm confused, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, but this bill, as I understand it, would not apply retroactively to what's in the next biennium's budget. It would take effect and apply to any negotiation that took place going forward. So if you're asking going forward under the collective bargaining arrangement, what would happen, I think we would be in a similar position to the position that we're in other collective bargaining arrangements when choices are made about funding in the legislature that look different than what's been agreed to. And I think, though, for this first agreement, one of the challenges and one of the reasons for this bill, which is kind of where I was trying to start if I'm not being clear, one of the reasons for the bill is that there is more vulnerability under the meet and confer process that was originally designed through executive order, which is why we're supportive of codifying a collective bargaining arrangement so that these workers can have more certainty in the state and can have a better position of bargaining power with the state as we negotiate rates going forward.
And I appreciate that, but I'm speaking in the context of this bill. And like I said, if you can't answer the question, feel free to say that and get back to us with an answer. But under collective bargaining agreements and with the traditional employer-employee relationships, if the legislature doesn't fund the whatever was agreed to by the executive branch, the executive branch then has to reduce workforce in order to fund at the level that they agreed to do benefits and salary benefits to their workers. They can't go in and say, well, the legislature didn't fund it, so we're going to lower your benefits by X percentage because the legislature didn't fund it. The executive branch has to eliminate workers to meet the budgetary amount they are allowed to spend, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. But in this case, where you don't have an employer, an employee, what would happen after this bill is to pass and the executive branch agrees to a compensation rate and the legislature doesn't fund to that level? Do you you cannot go back and say, well, we're going to lower the compensation rate because you've got a collective bargaining agreement reached with this group. Are you going to eliminate child care providers then?
Mr. Chair, I think I understand better now what you're asking. You're asking, looking ahead, if this were to be codified and the legislature weren't prospectively, once collective bargaining is in place and what's been agreed to as part of that is not then funding, you're talking about that dynamic around the fact that we're not the employer. And I think the issue is there that most likely there would have to be funding from someplace else in the Department of Human Services budget that would support whatever had been bargained. And I think that's the case with any other group as well. That it's not necessarily that people lose their jobs when the legislature doesn't fund what's been agreed to. I think what you have to look at is the totality of the budget that the agreement sits within. And this particular budget for the employment-related daycare program is within the Department of Human Services budget. So I think what you would be talking about is a situation wherein there would be other programs potentially affected inside DHS that would need to be there would need to be funding reductions to support the funding that had been agreed to through this program.
Madam, Mr. Chair.
Senator Laughlin first.
Okay, certainly.
I appreciate that answer. I want to pose another possibility. Tell me if you think it fits as well. If the legislature chose to not honor the agreement and not fund the amount that was promised by the state, then could you not also reopen negotiations with the other side in order to see what an acceptable solution might be?
Chair Beyer, Senator Vakian, that's something we would have to check with the folks over at DAS in terms of how that reopener would happen, but certainly we'll try to get that information for you.
What I'm posing is not that you could force a reopening of the negotiations, but if both parties wanted to reopen the negotiation to come to a mutual solution, you certainly can do that with collective bargaining agreements. I don't know why you couldn't do it with this.
That's right. Correct. Senator Warbeck.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The governor's recommended budget had $35 million for employment-related daycare. What's in the co-chair's budget?
There were three pieces, and I didn't bring with me the breakdown of exactly. Oh, I think actually I do have their cost. The governor's budget recommended three things. One was to increase the number of people who would be eligible for the subsidy. Currently in the state, we serve people only with incomes under 150% of the federal poverty level. And what the governor's budget proposes to do is expand eligibility to families who are up to 185% of the federal poverty level. In addition, the governor's budget also reduced the amount of copayment that a family would be responsible for. And again, Oregon has one of the highest copayments in the country currently that families are responsible for paying, and this would continue a copay obligation on the part of a family but reduce it so that this could be more affordable, and also so that providers, quite frankly, would then not have to, in many cases, I think, as you heard in the earlier testimony, families are not able to afford that copay, and providers continue to provide the care even without the copay. So what that effectively does is reduce their rate. The third piece of the governor's budget had to do with increasing the subsidy level from what is currently 20% of market rate. That translate at its highest level to the fact that as a parent, I can access 20% of the market and 26% of the market in my community with the rate that we are currently paying as a state. That very much limits people's options when it comes to finding child care, particularly when you're a person who's working different hours. We in the governor's budget propose to increase that up to 75% of the market rate. So that means that those families who benefit from this program would now have access to 75 out of 100 of providers in their community and have more options in terms of their choice around quality. My understanding from the co-chair's budget is that with respect to the dollars that were funded, that funded the rate increase, the co-chair's budget reduced that by half. And the intent, as I understand it, and I will clarify if I hear differently, and I'm sure you will also seek out this information, Senator Gordley, but is that they, in their budget, reduced that to 50% of the market rate in terms of an increase for the providers, but that they kept in the budget the two pieces relative to the copayment reduction and the increase in eligibility from 150% to 185% of the federal poverty level.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
I've got, this is listed in groups of three. Why don't you come up together? And I will try to honor that. We've already kind of gone out of order. But also we have someone who's checked that they came from more than 100 miles to testify. And we have a policy that they get to testify first. So it's Emma Valesco. And then with her, Linda Durham and Marla Baker.
Hola, my name is Emma Velasco. I live in Lincoln County and am a mother with two children, a 15-year-old son and a 23-year-old daughter. She is a single mother with a 13-month-old daughter. I willingly commute to Portland to provide child care for my granddaughter, Amani. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 788. Which grants child care providers like myself collective bargaining rights. I believe a union would have created fairness and equality when I had felt targeted most recently. Ojalá SEIU would support me and my complaint recognized en el futuro, in the future. All in all, I urge you all to support SB 788 by giving nosotros, we child care provider workers, a voice on the job. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go next.
Hi, my name is Marla Baker. I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. I care for four of my six grandchildren. She's not one of the ones that I care for, but she got to come today. Thank you very much. I'm here to support Senate Bill 788, the collective bargaining bill, which will give us bargaining rights. We're out there alone in our houses with no voice. We don't have a caseworker. My daughter has a caseworker. She has somebody to call. We have nobody to call. The one time that I did try to call to get questions on just how to fill out the paperwork, the only answer I got was, well, you're self-employed. You own your own business. I can't tell you how to do that. You own your own business. I can't tell you how to do that. So I don't know where else I'm supposed to go to get any kind of information. We need a say in our pay, our benefits, our training, and who better to advocate for the children than the care providers. So I really urge you to support this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Durham. I care for six of my grandchildren in Aloha. I'm here to support Senate Bill 788, which will give us real bargaining rights. Sorry. I believe this bill will support a family's rights to choose who their children go to for care. Our family values are built on consistency and integrity. But the low pay makes it really difficult to pay for good food, pay the mortgage, utilities, and basically, hugs and kisses at my house and all grandma's houses are free. But the worrying about money, the stress, is a price that a child should never have to pay, ever. So I'm urging you, please, to support this bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Vaughan.
Would one of you explain where, just to clarify for the record, where the money comes from? When you have, just take an example, one kid come in, and a certain amount of money follows that kid in with you. Where does the money come from?
The state.
All of it?
Except for their copay.
And the copay comes from?
The mother.
And about what percentage is that of the total?
I have one daughter that is a single parent and is living at home. I couldn't even fathom her getting her own place. She pays, her copay is 50% of the pay. What I should receive for doing her child care is about 300 something a month. And her copay is 50% of that. So my check is $174 for 1 month of caring for that one child.
Do you ever have trouble with folks not being able to make their copays?
Absolutely.
All the time.
We have to loan it to our kids so they can pay it to us.
It basically comes in and we have to pay it back out.
Do you ever send the kids back?
Our grandkids?
When they can't, when the copay can't come in?
No.
No, sir.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Ms. Velasco. Thank you very much for traveling the distance to be with us this afternoon. You said in your testimony that you were targeted?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you explain what you meant by that? May I ask?
Yes, I was in January requested by DHS to have my fingerprints, to have my photo ID, and to have them do the criminal check on me. When I wondered, is everybody being asked to do the same? Especially when I looked at my manual for child care providers and it said Social Security is optional, but do put in your individual taxpayer identity number. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I too really feel like I'm targeted.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Darcy Ryan, Hilda Chavez, and Jana Roberts.
My name is Darcy Ryan. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I've been a child care provider through ERDC for almost 10 years. I currently don't have any full-time kids because of some of the exact reasons we're here today talking about copays and rates and this and that, and I am the turnover that needs to be stopped. I want my career to be recognized as a real job. I feel like I'm overworked and underpaid, and after 10 years, I should have gotten a raise, health coverage, advanced in some way. So I urge you to support SB 788. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jana Roberts. I'm from Salem. I provide care for my three grandchildren and two other children. Last month, I applied for food stamps and was denied because I'm a part-time student and who is not able to do my work study because of the child care. I'm considered self-employed, and I don't make $8.55 a month, so that disqualified me. In turn, this affected my ability to provide snacks and juice and healthy meals for the children I care for. I work 9.5 hours a day caring for an autistic child and four others. Yet I don't make enough, and we deserve the right to have a voice and bargain for these children and their parents in order to help improve the quality of care. That is why I'm asking you to support SB 788, granting child care provider collective bargaining rights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Breyer, I've been asked by Hilda to translate for her.
Okay.
That's all right.
Mi nombre es Hilda Chavez.
My name is Hilda Chavez.
Yo soy cuidadora de niños.
I am a child care provider.
Y vivo en Forest Grove.
And I live in Forest Grove.
Estoy aquí para apoyar la medida del Senado 788.
I am here to, in support of Senate Bill 788.
La cual nos va a dar el derecho de tener o de negociar.
Which would give us the right and ability to negotiate.
Con el Estado sobre nuestro trabajo.
With the state over issues related to our work.
Yo pienso que la medida del 788.
I believe that Senate Bill 788
nos permitirá mejorar
will allow us to improve
la calidad de servicio,
the quality of service,
de proveer mejor,
in order to provide better,
servir a los niños y a las familias,
better services and for their parents and children.
Yo pienso esto.
I believe this because
porque me permite.
Because it allows me,
como asistimos en esta mañana,
It would allow me, as we did this morning,
negociar con las personas,
to negotiate with people,
que dirigen este programa,
with the people who direct this
para
program,
para desarrollar,
to improve
entrenamientos,
trainings
que nos ayuden,
that help us,
a proveer mejor cuidado de niños,
trainings that help us to provide better quality care.
Yo les quiero pedir,
I'm asking you,
que por favor nos apoyen,
to please support us in this.
Gracias.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I have Nettie Taylor. And Marion McDonald and Shauna Aldis. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My name is Nettie Taylor. I live in Portland, Oregon. I take care of my five grandkids. I was taking care of six, but one's turned 13. I won't take care of her anymore. One of them turned 12. I won't take care of her anymore. But that's one of them take care of. I'm here to support Senate Bill 788, which will give us real collective bargaining rights. I believe that having a union will improve stability for the child care providers. Right now we have no voice, and the rate of pay is not enough to pay my bills. Sometimes I think about getting a second job, and I know if I get a second job, it's going to be hard on the parents and my grandchildren, because that's who I keep. And they're going to put, like, if I go out, while I'm out looking for a second job, my daughter is going to have to ask for a leave of absence while I go out, because won't be nobody there to take care of kids. And that would defeat the purpose of taking care of the children. That's why I'm asking you to support the Senate 788. Thank you.
The chair?
Yes.
I have a question, and I guess it's I can ask you, and it's relevant to a number of the testifiers that we've heard. How often do you get or not get your full copay?
It varies. Sometimes I get half. Sometimes it's like one of the other ladies said, you have to give them the money to pay you. You know, they come, you know. I don't get it as often as I would like, but I do get my copay every now and then.
Okay.
When she gets a raise.
Okay.
She gets a raise, we don't.
Yeah. Thank you.
You have a question? Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Marion McDonald, and I am a state-certified family child care provider in Northeast Portland. For the last 11 years, I have operated as I grow, serving infants and toddlers in ages ranging from 6 weeks old to 3 years old. I am here as a voice for Oregon's 4,400 licensed family child care providers to support Senate Bill 788 relating to child care provider collective bargaining rights. I began caring for children in 1996 when I was searching for child care for my 2-year-old granddaughter. Her mother was young, single, and low income. I immediately saw the need for care for infants and toddlers. I quit my private industry corporate job and became a certified family child care provider in an effort to serve more than 2 children under the age of 2 years old. That's part of the regulations, the difference between registered providers and certified. Currently, I choose to care for a daily maximum of 6 children with an assistant. I am certified for 12 children a day. I'm an active member of several child care provider associations, national, statewide, local, and international. The National Association of Family Child Care, National Association for the Education for Young Children, and its state affiliate, Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children, Provider Resource Organization, Oregon Family Child Care Network, Professional Association of Certified Child Care Educators, and International Family Child Care Association. I am currently in the process of becoming a nationally accredited family child care provider, of which there are only currently four in Oregon. Each of these associations have in their mission statement or purpose similar goals: to educate family child care providers in ways to communicate with other early childhood care and education professionals, to assist in the advancement of the family child care profession, to provide a communication system that will promote partnership between family child care providers and other provider support organizations and local, state, and national policymakers, opportunities, resources, and recognition for the development of family child care providers, and encouragement to providers to strive for excellence in caring for children. These associations, while each serving a very small group of Oregon family child care providers, have not demonstrated their effectiveness in including or representing the larger base of Oregon's family child care providers. These associations may have an annual conference, produce a newsletter, or sponsor meetings that often draw less than five attendees. Other agencies that serve family child care providers, for instance, resource and referrals and provider networks, also serve a small group of providers, but often they operate on contracts that may or may not include trainings, grants, or support that is available to all providers. These agencies have income guidelines or other factors that might exclude some providers. For the last 2 years, I have served on a volunteer basis on the steering committee and the bargaining team with AFSCME Child Care Providers Together, Local 132. Many providers, like myself, spent one Saturday a month for 8 months meeting with lead staff from the Child Care Division and the Department of Human Services. Everyone involved in our meet and confer process came away with a real understanding of issues, ways to address these issues, and how all parties could take an active role and responsibility in changes. Currently, AFSCME Child Care Providers Together, Local 132, is the only resource that all Oregon-licensed family child care providers can access that identifies, reaches out, and serves in a very timely manner training needs, support with grievances, assistance with paperwork, and many other needs that have been identified by providers. There are approximately 20% of Spanish-speaking licensed family child care providers in our union. AFSCME has had great success in reaching out to family child care providers who speak languages other than English and in all regions of Oregon. We also have members who speak Russian, Vietnamese, and Chinese. Our partner agencies have recently made available documents that have been translated into languages other than English, and those were through our meet and confer process with CCD and DHS. AFSCME family child care providers have testified in the Joint Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee for support in those subsidy rate increases. We want to advocate for changes in our profession, to work with the agencies that regulate our profession, and to hopefully be a model for other states in their quest for higher quality early childhood and education professionals serving as family child care providers. I hope to achieve through the union further successes for family child care providers in the form of continued progress in securing health insurance, empowering family child care providers to realize their potential, and for some providers to become licensed or to achieve a higher licensing status. Without collective bargaining, family child care providers in Oregon will surely lose so much that we have worked for in the last 2 years. Family child care providers are finally being recognized for their valuable work, their impact on Oregon's economy, and their respect as professionals. Meet and Confer has served AFSCME family child care providers to this point. Now it's time to make our agreement more solid. Collective bargaining rights in Senate Bill 788 are crucial in advancing the progress we've worked for so diligently and made so far. Thank you for your attention and for your consideration of my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
You go ahead, please.
My name is Shanna Aldis, and I provide child care in Salem, Oregon, and I'm here to support Bill 788. I began providing child care 13 years ago to be able to stay home with my children and earn extra income. As time went by, I began to understand the importance of a child care provider to what the importance they have in children's lives. The providers, along with the parents, in nurturing and educating the children from day one, and then when they put their children into child care, how important that is. So I decided to make my child care my profession and my career so I can make the difference in lives. The first step, I enrolled in Chemeketa Community College to begin to get my degree in early childhood education and receive as much training wherever I could get it as possible. I received many hours of training, and as I received it, I moved from registered family child care to certified, and now I'm large certified group. I provide child care for 16 children a day, ages 6 weeks to 10 years old. I have qualified staff that work with me. And through the years, there's been things that I'd like to have changed, but with just one person and providing all this care, it's really hard to make an impact anywhere. And so when I heard of the union starting to form, I jumped at the chance of joining them. And then I became involved. I'm on the steering committee and presently running for Valley Regional Representative. Becoming a member at AskMe meant bringing child care providers together to help us have a voice on issues that directly affected our child care businesses. An example is the pay rate, which we've been hearing about through DHS. There hasn't been an increase in years that's even noticeable. But now there's other people than one provider trying to get an increase for the providers. Today I had an interview, and it was a special needs child, and they're on DHS, and you have to feed the child through a tube, and she has spinal bifida, and AFS will pay me about $380 to take care of her, minus the copay, within my 16. And so I'm supposed to provide care for this child and hire an extra staff and do all the special tube feedings every 2 hours for this child for $380 a month is what they're going to pay me. Because the mother's desperate and because, you know, I've met the child and the parent really wants to work and better herself, she can stay home on Social Security and, you know, stay home with the child, but she wants to actually get out there and better herself for her child. But most daycare providers won't take special needs, let alone $380 a month to provide. You know, it's going to cost me more in staff than care for this, than what I'll get paid for the child, but I'm willing to do this. So that's, you know, with all of us together, you know, with the collective bargaining, we're able to work together and see an improvement. And it's very important, you know, not for the children that have, you know, good families and can afford the child care, but also for the young parents that have special needs, children that they don't have a choice out there, first of all, and then the pay, you know, and so, but thank you.
There's no difference in pay for a special needs spina bifida child than for a normal child?
Yeah, there's about $20 difference.
Oh, big deal.
Yeah. And feed tubing, or feeding her through a tube every 2 hours, you get about $20 a month more.
That shocks me.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I have two people left that have signed up. Now, is Sue Mackey here? I thought you said she's not here. Okay. Kathleen, is it Hines? That's all I have on the list. Is there anybody else who did not get a chance to sign up and wishes to testify? Okay.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Hines, and I am the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division. The Child Care Division is part of the Oregon Employment Department, and we are the licensing agency for child care. My comments will be brief. We're just here to let you know that the agency does have some issues with the definitions that are in the Senate Bill 788. However, we have consulted with the sponsors of the bill, and we believe that we can work with them and that we can come to some agreement on workable definitions. We would also prefer that the provisions in this bill reside elsewhere than where they are placed, which is in ORS 657A, and that is our regulatory statute. And we will be neutral on this bill when these issues are resolved. And again, we have spoken with the proponents of the legislation, and we feel that we will be able to work these issues out. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, what are the issues?
With the definitions, for example, the issues were with several of the definitions. They run counter or conflicting to some of the definitions that are currently in our regulatory statute. And the other issue of concern to us is the placement of these collective bargaining provisions in the Child Care Division's regulatory statute for child care.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 788, and thank you, ladies, for sitting with us. Any questions? Would you like to make a statement?
She's thinking.
Again, thank you for being here. Thank you all for coming, and committee is adjourned.
Appreciate you the last hour. Nicely done.